Welcome again to The Good Word. We're studying Joshua. I am your host, Bob Resch. With me are my conversation partners, Dr. Matilda Fry and Dr. Jody Washburn. We resume our study of the book of Joshua with something that's called the enemy within, and it has to do with the conquest of Jericho. Now, I have driven past Jericho, but I don't know the area well. And I understand that its size is not certain, probably about 7 acres, and nobody's sure where the boundaries have been or were. And I'm wondering about all the Israelites in Joshua's army who are to conquer Joshua. And I'm troubled by a Hebrew word that I don't know, can't even pronounce, but I understand it could mean more than one thing. Dr. Fry, could you help us with it?
I think you refer to the number and the word that is the first letter of the alphabet, the Aleph, and this letter is used to designate different things in the biblical text. And so it can mean the word for the number 1,000. It can also be the word that is used for a unit, for example, an army unit, a military unit. What else? Are there other examples, Jody?
Oh, I mean, sometimes people say it can be used to mean tribe or to mean a group of 1,000.
Mm-hmm.
Perhaps a military company.
Mm-hmm. Now, that company can be in different sizes.
Mm-hmm.
And so, but the same word is used for it. If it is 100 or 500 or 1,000, and it's the same word. So that is why we are unsure of the precise meaning for it.
Yeah.
So Joshua had many soldiers, even if we're not sure how many. And they're going to attack Jericho in a very curious fashion. There's trumpets, and I've heard those trumpets, and it's not necessarily a pleasant sound. But then the warriors are just marching around, and you imagine the suspense on day one as the people of Jericho, who are well prepared for a siege, see an army that's not going to besiege them. They have no equipment, no siege ladders, no towers, if they could get up the sloping sides of the mound even. But they're perfectly silent except for these miserable trumpets. And they're going all around the city, and then they're gone. And now tomorrow they come back. What questions are coming to the minds of the people of Jericho? They don't know Joshua's battle plan. I don't even know if all the Israelites knew Joshua's battle plan, but is this psychological warfare, and is that fair?
Yeah, that is rather quite how to say, you know, a caricature of war.
Yeah,
there are no weapons available. They are not at all in the biblical text. So there are the trumpets, and there is the ark in the front, and the priests carry it. And the people are supposed to be very silent. And only at the end, on the seventh day, when they march for 7 times, and at the very end, they are supposed to shout.
Well, imagine the suspense building on that seventh day.
Right.
Everybody knows what happens at the end of one march, nothing. But this is, they got 2 today, and then 3 and 4, and the kids are all working on their fingers for mathematics. What happens when nobody's talking, nobody's shouting, there's just these trumpets, and suddenly the whole group stops? And then there's the most awful sound you ever heard of all these trumpets and all the people who were silent before. And what results does it have according to our story?
The shout and the loud noise brings the walls down.
Whew! And the city may have been built to withstand siege, but it would be hard to build a city to withstand earthquakes, which happen in that part of the world. I understand the Jordan is a rift valley. It has earthquakes. So what shall we say about this apparently successful siege of Jericho? Most unconventional warfare. And was it a glorious victory with everybody in Jericho dead? And is that the goal? And all the spoil belongs to God, and why would that be the goal? And how does the day end? Everyone's singing good songs. And they feel so good that they can relax about any further conquests. There's another much smaller town just a few miles away. What should we do about that?
I think it's interesting that there is the first city, Jericho, which is, according to the way it is described in the text, is the fortified one and is strong and is prepared. And there is a king who is in charge, right? Whereas the second one is much more like obtuse and unclear what happens. And yet there is so much fear and so much preparation or planning going on for that one. And the wars or the fighting is very different between Jericho and Ai, second city.
So, Dr. Fry, would you pronounce the name of this curious little town so that I can get it straight?
Ai.
Yeah. Ai, ai.
Yeah. Ai. And doesn't it in Hebrew just mean like a ruin?
I've been told that, yes.
So the juxtaposition or the, you know what I mean, the setting of the two stories side by side in the narrative that you bring up is fascinating.
Yes.
That where you should be in fear and trepidation, you don't sense that, you know what I mean? And then there's this quick conquering, you kill everyone inside, you take the plunder, you know? And then you're pointing out that the whole experience of the Israelites around Ai is sort of put beside that in the narrative. I see a little bit of humor there.
So Joshua had been a spy, now he sends spies to check out Ai. And they come back with a great report. And they said, don't worry about it at all. Mm-hmm. We won't even need very many of the army. Take a small group up there. The people are weak. They don't have much resistance. You can kind of take a vacation this day. And what happened when Israel attacked Ai?
Yes, you have thousands of men, Israelite men, fleeing from some people in Ai, even though they are supposed to be so few and unprepared and so on. And people of Joshua's people get killed and so on, and they get pursued. And so they have to regroup and re-establish their armies again to fight. And finally, at the end, they get it. But, you know, it's a huge struggle.
Well, there's a story that goes between these two Ai stories, and that's Achan. Do you want to talk about him? Achan did a bad thing, and it's described in some detail. He confessed it. So was he a risk to his nuclear family by doing this, and how does that work?
Well, since we already talked about the law from Deuteronomy that when they are supposed to fight and go into the land and fight against the people, they are supposed to destroy everything. The Hebrew has a term for that, that is called cherem. And this is an expression that talks about this kind of war where everything from men, women, children to animals, and all the material things are supposed to be destroyed. In Jericho, we had everybody killed at the end except for Rahab and her family, but then the metals, the gold, the silver, iron and so on, those kind of materials could be saved and could be used in the house of God. That's how text puts it. Now, here in Ai, we have a man, one single person, who feels there is something precious here that I would like to keep.
He's in Jericho, but he affects Ai.
Yes.
Yes, all right.
And so he takes some of the things, and he hides it. And that becomes the reason for the failure to take over the city.
What do you think of the method by which Achan is identified? I was taught not to throw dice, and my parents even discouraged board games that involved dice, because that was kind of like gambling. And yet, when you want to, in the Bible, when you want to learn some important fact, what's one of the things you early think of is pulling shards out of a pot or something like that. What was the idea there?
Again, we are in a setting where God is in charge, and God works through means that we do not use today in our modern Christian world either, like throwing a dice to decide who is guilty or not guilty. But here in this context, we see that happen. And so that is part of the, again, of that ancient context of like the God who is in charge is working with those means. And we have it part of the biblical story, and we have it part of the context of these stories in other literature.
If we live in a place where, look, I didn't do it, and you didn't do it, so still it happened, it must be that God did it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, as I read this, I just can't help. I have to say I shudder a little bit when I read stories that have, you know, someone transgresses an agreement, and then the women and children and animals, you know, everybody's basically annihilated because of that. It brings up sort of a
That's response. A healthy physiologic reaction, isn't it?
and so, like, I'm just looking here at the end of chapter 7, you know, it says, you know, that they stoned him first, and after that they stoned the rest and they burned them, which was part of the Cherem laws, I believe. And then they heaped up this large pile of stones that remains until this day. And then there's this explanation. The Lord turned from his fierce anger. And it reminds me of a quote that's been coming to my mind often in these conversations from Rob Bell, who talks about, like, how do we make sense of violence in the Bible, especially reading from a Christian lens where we think of Jesus as the one that lays down his life for us, you know? And Rob Bell doesn't shy away from saying that we are getting in these texts the contextual perceptions of God. So in a cultural context where everything big is understood as coming from God, for instance. So let me just read this. He says, the Bible is a library of books reflecting how human beings have understood the divine. People at that time believed the gods were with them when they went to war and killed everyone in the village. And he just reminds readers, like, we're reading someone's perspective rising from a particular time and place that reflects how they understood God. So he says straight out, we can read this, and we don't have to take it as the ultimate, absolute description of God's perspective. It is the people's perspective on God's perspective.
What a relief. Now, can we leave these stories where they came from, that part of the Bible, and move one of these times to Jesus of Nazareth, who behaved very differently from anybody in the book of Joshua? Can we save that? Can we still be Bible believers and followers of Jesus and do that with our minds?
Some people would go so far as to say that every reader of Scripture is a selective reader. So I think we have lots of options.
But just bring it back. So Joshua and Jesus is the same name.
It's the same
name.
Word. Yep.
It's the same word.
Yep.
It's the one who saves,
yep.
Right? And so we can leave the stories behind, but...
So does God, save through conquest?
Yes.
Does God save through incarnation?
Well, if we want to save Joshua and company, come back next week. We may remember that they did attack Ai successfully a few days later, and who planned their battle strategy on that day, which was very different from the one that Joshua planned himself. That will be the end of Joshua for today. And for this week, our time is up, but we'll have many more questions about Joshua. Again, thank you to our technician, Corin Bailey, to my conversation partners, Dr. Fry, Dr. Washburn. Again, I am Bob Resch, and I hope you can join us again next week for more of The Good Word.
You've been listening to Good Word, a production of the School of Theology at Walla Walla University and KGTS-FM. To order a copy of today's broadcast, you can call 509-527-2194. Thanks for listening, and we'll be here next week at this time with Good Word.